It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And for the rest of the program today, we're speaking with a retired scholar from the University of Illinois about her life and work. Valerie Hoffman was a professor of Islamic studies in the Department of Religion. She entered the field by studying Arabic in the early 1970s, when that was a relatively obscure thing to do, at least in America. She began teaching at the U of I in the 1980s, and over the years, her field of study would become increasingly relevant to the American mass public.
On October the 6th, 1973, Egyptian troops went into action to try and push Israel out of the Sinai Peninsula.
Some 60 Americans are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going off all over the sky.
This is as close as we can get to the base of the World Trade Center. You can see the firemen assembled here, the police officers, FBI agents, and you can see the two towers. A huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way!
Today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year.
That is, of course, just one lens on recent history. Professor Valerie Hoffman has others, and she joins me now. Welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for making the time to be with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I want to begin, how does a young woman from mid-century America grow up to be a scholar of Islam?
I was interested in other languages and cultures from the time I was young. I grew up in the New York area and majored in anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania, where they have a lot of instruction and a beautiful museum dealing with the ancient Near East. I was considering studying an ancient Near Eastern language and was told that was really for doctoral students. And I thought, that's okay, I'll study Arabic. That way, if I'm ever digging in Iraq or Egypt, I can speak with the people. And but by studying Arabic, you immediately start coming into contact with aspects of the culture. And so I spent my junior year at the University of Tunis in Tunisia, North Africa. And that's where I really became interested in Islam because of its impact on the culture.
And I want to interrupt you there to ask, so this year in Tunis, what was it like being a young white American woman in that place at that time?
It was very difficult. I'll be totally honest about that. I did not go with a program. So in a sense, I was somewhat unprotected and had to fight a bit to get into the university, because even though I knew I qualified, they kept, quote unquote, losing my registration papers.
And oh my goodness.
I, for a sort of shy kid, I rapidly had to learn to have some courage and assertiveness. So that was difficult. Also, it's a problem in many countries, of course, but there was terrible sexual harassment because, especially with regard to Western women, because of the sorts of movies we export, the shows we export, it gives an impression to people overseas that Western women are very loose. So I was only a 19-year-old girl, and yes, it was challenging. Also, the students went on strike in February of that year and never returned to the classroom. So I ended up having to make independent arrangements with my professors to write papers, and they would write letters to my home university in the hope I could get credit for the year. So.
Wow, what a life experience, though.
Yes, indeed.
So you later spent a year in Cairo. Was that any better? Was that different?
It was very different, and yes, it was wonderful. This is a program called the Center for Arabic Study Abroad Program. The acronym is CASA, and it's funded by the U.S. government. It's an advanced Arabic language immersion program, and it was very competitive to get into. And when they actually taught us to speed read in Arabic. All our class discussions were in Arabic. We listened to lectures and took notes in Arabic. They even collected our notebooks to make sure we weren't taking notes in English. and by the end of that year, I was writing papers in Arabic. And all of this was before I even started graduate school. So I was very fortunate in being able to start graduate school with that kind of fluency in Arabic.
What did your friends and family think of that choice to become a scholar of Islam eventually?
Ah, how interesting. You know, at the start, when I first started studying Arabic, my father had a rather negative view, as I think many Americans have a negative view. And he said, well, if you're going to study a non-Western language, you should choose one that has a civilization, like, Sanskrit or Chinese. And I thought, really? My father is not an uneducated person. And to his credit, he ended up just going to our public library and taking out books on Islamic civilization, because Arabic is one of the great languages of world civilizations. And because it was the literary language of a huge area of the world, even if people didn't speak Arabic in their everyday lives, if they were writing scholarly works for centuries, they used Arabic. And really, it's only in the 20th century that indigenous languages really began to be used instead of Arabic for scholarly purposes.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with retired professor Valerie Hoffman about her life and work in Islamic studies at the University of Illinois. I played that montage of events, admittedly a very Western U.S. lens, but on the October War or Yom Kippur War, the Iranian hostage crisis, the Gulf War, 9/11, the global war on terror. We don't have time to talk about them all, but maybe you can pick one of those and say how that changed your life and your work and your field.
Yes. Well, in a sense, I would have to say they all did. I mean, in 1973, because of the October War, and then in 1974, because of the oil embargo as a result of U.S. support for Israel, the Arabic language instruction shot up 50% in that one year. That's way back in the 70s. So
there had been 18 schools in the entire country.
Exactly. There had been 18 universities that taught Arabic, whereas now Arabic is even taught at some secondary schools. So things have changed considerably. And each of these events led, of course, to an increasing perception of the relevance of studying Arabic and of Islam, even though, of course, it's a very unfortunate association from the perspective of Muslims. There may not be any linkage between Islam as a religion and any one of these events, but of course religion has been used for political purposes, there's no question. Probably the 9/11 attacks were certainly the incident that brought that really, I think, made all of us who were scholars in Islamic thought have to suddenly become experts on contemporary politics. Now, I had started that beforehand in a sense, you know, when I was a totally apolitical graduate student focusing on Islamic philosophy and theology. But with the first Gulf War in the early 90s, I was often interviewed by the news media. So I rapidly became aware of many things, but 9/11 made all of us realize that, you know, we can't talk about Islam without having it in some sense be seen as a political message, whether or not we intend it to be. And so it certainly highlighted our awareness of that.
So as the American mass public begins to develop an understanding, and maybe they hadn't even thought much about Islam at all in the past, right, before some of these mass news events, I wonder how your classroom changed over that time. Maybe the demographics of your students or the acceptance of your students? I don't know.
Absolutely. That, yes, it has changed a lot. When my position here was actually, I started teaching here in 1983 as a visiting lecturer, and there was no Islam being taught, no Islam courses at that time being taught in the what was then the program in religious studies. And it was the director of the what was then the program in African studies, now it's the Center for African Studies, Professor Charles Stewart, when he was director, he got funding, federal funding, to promote language and cultural studies pertaining to Africa. And he was a specialist in Islam in Mauritania and was aware that there was a need for Islam to be taught. And so he proposed this, this two-year sort of trial with the program in religious studies. So my first 2 years, I was 50% with African studies and 50% with religious studies. At that time, the dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences didn't think anyone but Muslims would be interested in Islam. Years later, we had a second faculty person who was teaching Islam. So one thing certainly is a huge difference in the recognition at the administrative level. In 1986, they approved a tenure line position, and I had to apply for it like everybody else. But another thing, of course, is that in the 1980s, you know, many of the Muslim students on our campus, most of them were foreign-born, and saw the United States as basically hostile to Islam and to their culture. And some of them saw my appointment as symbolic of the hostility of the university toward Islam, because this white woman.
What right do you have to teach this subject?
Exactly, exactly. It kind of reminds me, though, of a former now retired African-American woman who in the Department of English, who was a specialist in Shakespeare, and people kind of went, "What? What are you doing teaching Shakespeare? You're African American. You should be teaching African American literature." So I think that there is a natural but misguided kind of perception that you should only be teaching things that accord with your own personal background. Now, in my early years, for one thing, I was fairly young, not horribly young. I was 29 when I started teaching here, but I looked younger. People would say to me, "Are you a grad or undergrad student?"
Sure.
And so maybe that also was a factor in that there would sometimes be Muslim students who were not enrolled in the class coming in to try to correct me in class. They would sort of sit in my introduction to Islam class. One of them once actually stood up at the end of class and yelled to the class, "Don't read what she tells you to read. Read Sayyid Qutb and Maududi," who are two representatives of what we would call sort of a more radical Islamist perspective of promoting jihad and things like that. So, although, I mean, some people would say, no, they really weren't promoting jihad in the way that Al-Qaeda is. Does, but whatever. Yeah. In any case, they were radical. They are not representative of Islam as a whole. One thing I learned over time.
I should say we are almost out of time, but go ahead. Sure.
Yikes. Okay. I learned that I had to sort of set boundaries. That there is a great deal of diversity in Islam, so nobody could speak on behalf of Islam as a whole. They could only. They could speak about their own experience and what they'd heard, but you know, even in the student body, there's a great deal of diversity. And in the 1990s, things really started changing. The Muslim students tended to be American-born and tended to have much more diverse perspectives and be much more accepting of me as well.
And I think that is a great maybe to be continued. I hope we can have you back, Valerie Hoffman, retired professor from the University of Illinois in Islamic Studies, because there is so much more to talk about. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you for having me.
And that is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be taking a deep dive into Illinois' new assault weapons ban and some of the court battles that have followed from that and what it might mean for Illinois gun owners, as well as the few remaining companies that manufacture firearms in Illinois. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.